This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Take Kenya, for example. They have had a security cooperation since the 70s. This is the first time, by the way, that a Secretary of Defense from the United States has visited Kenya since 1976.
That's Carla Babb, VOA Pentagon correspondent in Nairobi, reporting on the visit to Kenya by U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Details coming up. Also, several human rights organizations and Sudanese citizens held a rally in front of the White House. And Eswatini heads towards elections. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Analysts say there is a growing dilemma and uncertainty over whether to engage military juntas in the Sahel as the European Union and other Western nations grapple with how to establish engagement in the aftermath of recent coups in the region. VOA's Ignatius Anor attended an event here in Washington and has the story.
The aftermath of recent coups in Niger and other parts of Western Central Africa has Europe and its Western allies scrambling for a solution to the political instability. The dilemma prompted a roundtable discussion held by New Lines Institute, a Washington-based think tank with panelists which included top European Union diplomats to explore the 27-nation bloc's engagement in the Sahel, says Damien Cristofari, the European Affairs Senior Advisor at the French Embassy.
Probably in the coming days, and probably more days than weeks, things will evolve, and we will probably have to reassess the situation. There are talks currently in New York between various actors on this issue. So I think it's a bit too early to tell what's next, because we are again still in the very heart of the crisis, so we have to let the dust settle and see what we can do and what we cannot do.
Peter Tuma, a visiting fellow at the Atlantic Council, another think tank in Washington, told VOA that there's division within the top hierarchy of the EU over their next line of action in the Sahel.
There will be a discussion, and we are in the very beginning. I'm afraid that this will be tough to find a common line. As before, it was strongly driven by France and EU, European External Service. But nowadays, we have some of the EU member states which are trying to push for an alternative approach.
Michael Sherkin, Director of Global Program at the 14 North Strategies, a research center focusing on the continent, said the United States is taking a cautious approach in a region historically linked with the EU and France.
There's an interest on the part of a lot of people in Washington to try to distance ourselves somewhat from the French, in the hope of trying to maintain lines of communication with these juntas and trying to maintain some lines of communication also with the population of these countries, with the notion that maybe at least there'll be opportunities to do something, to engage constructively.
Sherkin says, despite significant interest in Washington to resolve the current political impasse in the region, there's nothing tangible on the table right now.
Although nobody actually has any clear ideas about what that thing will actually be. What do we actually do and how do we actually improve things?
The panelists also expressed concern over the continent's resolve to collaborate with Russia. They discussed the prevalence of increasing disinformation by the Kremlin on the continent, with the EU's top diplomat revealing that Europe is setting up an African unit to counter such propaganda. Ignatius Ano, VOA News, Washington.
Making his first trip to Africa as Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin yesterday met Somalia's President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud in Djibouti Today he's in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, where our Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb, is reporting on his visit. I first asked her to talk to us about Mr. Austin's discussion yesterday with the Somali leader. So first, the Somali president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, met Secretary Austin. What was their discussion yesterday?
Well, they had a very frank discussion about the progress that Secretary Austin said is being made against the al-Shabaab militants there. It's a hard fight, Secretary Austin said, but he pointed out to reporters that the Somalis have made more progress against the terror group in the past year than they had in the past 5 years combined. And this meeting is happening as the Somali president is asking the African Union to extend their drawdown and delay their drawdown by 3 months because, as the Somali president says, there have been some major setbacks. And in order to keep the security situation stable, he says he wants to keep those African Union forces in Somalia a little longer. We asked the secretary about this today, and he basically said that the Somali president is just focused on maintaining all of the progress that has been made, and he doesn't want to see the security situation slip. And so he's doing what he feels will help keep that security situation moving forward instead of slipping backward. Because if you look at the situation in Somalia, the Somalis have been very successful in pushing out the terror groups from the center of the country, but they are still able to make massive attacks. I mean, just over the last couple of days, we saw a truck bomb that killed more than 20 people. So there are still a lot of things that need to be done and a lot of security things that need to be done. But the Somalis are very focused on that, the secretary said.
So what happened in Nairobi today? He is in Kenya.
He is in Kenya. Somalia came up again because he thanked the Kenyans, his Kenyan counterpart, for the efforts that Kenya has made helping with Somali security. He also thanked the Kenyans for hosting American forces in Manda Bay. He will be visiting Manda Bay, the base in Kenya that holds U.S. troops, tomorrow. And this is all part, in his eyes, he's trying to go to security partners with Djibouti, visiting them first, with Kenya now, that have a long-standing relationship with the United States. Take Kenya, for example. They have had a security cooperation since the 70s. This is the first time, by the way, that a Secretary of Defense from the United States has visited Kenya since 1976. So it's quite a big deal here in Nairobi to have the Secretary visit today.
So what's next for the Secretary after Kenya?
So after Kenya, the Secretary is going to visit Angola. Angola may be a little bit of a surprise because there had not been that strong long security cooperation with Angola like there has been in Djibouti or Kenya. But the U.S. says that they would like to change that. And the secretary told reporters that the Angolans, actually, his counterpart reached out to him and said that they would like to cooperate more with the United States. And that is why they want to go there, because they want to try to make strengthen the ties that they have and start working not just on a military-to-military cooperation, but also to help with economic development as well.
And lastly, Carla, French President Macron yesterday said France will remove its military from Niger by the end of the year. And as you know, the U.S. has an air base in Niamey, the capital of Niger. Any remarks from the secretary on Niger, France withdrawing from Niger?
Yes, asked about Niger today, the secretary said that France definitely has the right to do whatever France wants when it comes to where its forces are across the globe. But he said that as for the United States made one change. They moved some forces out of the base in the capital, out to Agadez, which is about 1,000 kilometers away from the capital. But other than that, they are keeping the force numbers relatively the same. There are still about 1,000 American forces in Niger, and they have stopped doing counterterrorism operations in Niger right now with the Nigerian forces. And that is because they say they want to see a diplomatic solution. They want to make sure that the constitutionally elected government will be able to be in power. But the U.S. has still not officially called this a coup. And all the officials that I speak to keep referring to this as the attempted coup, because they say that they're hoping that diplomacy will win at the end of the day. And there are a lot of U.S. forces there, and there's a lot of equipment. They spent millions of dollars building that base in Agadez, Air Base 201. It has a lot of drone capability, so they can do intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance flights, so they can look at these terror groups that are basically exploding in West Africa. And so this base is very, very important. And I was talking to analysts, and they say if they lose this base in West Africa, the next closest base that America really has to launch intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance missions is from Djibouti, which is all the way on the other side of the continent. So they are taking this step by step, day by day. And while France has made their decision to pull out, the United States has not made any decision of that sort.
Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, shadowing Secretary Lloyd Austin in Nairobi. Thank you for your input.
You're welcome.
You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Gambia's foreign minister has expressed concern about recent overthrows of governments in West Africa. Mamadou Tangara says the administration in Banjul is working with members of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, to resolve the concerns and to expedite the transitional process to return the countries to constitutional rule. In an interview on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly going on in New York, VOA's Peter Cloti sat down with Foreign Minister Mamadou Tangara to discuss peace and political stability in West Africa and democracy in the Gambia.
The situation in the region is worrisome. We saw a series of coup d'etats in the region, which is very worrying for all of us. But I think it's important also to look at the realities on the ground. I always say that let's not only deal with the consequences, but let's look at the causes. But the challenge really is to strengthen democracy in our regions. But I always say that democracy also goes with a lot of expectations. You know, once you elect a government, people think that their life will change overnight, not knowing that our countries are faced with enormous challenges. And sometimes when leaders are campaigning, they make a lot of promises. But today, one of the biggest challenges is the rise of the jihadist movement in our region. And we know that what affects one directly affects all of us indirectly, some more directly than others. And so that's why we are all concerned about the situation. Of course, the latest one in Niger, for us, there is no justification for that coup, because from all accounts, President Bazoum was doing extremely well. And this is unheard of. How can one day the head of your presidential guard will just keep you? It's just like kidnapping him. So that's why we are very worried about the situation. But as ECOWAS, we are trying to see how best we can resolve the problem through peaceful means. But of course, they are not ruling out the option of using force. But ideally, we would want it to be resolved through dialogue.
Looking at the role the Gambia is playing, I mean, Gambia is always a friendly nation, you know, working with other countries. But do you think the Gambia is doing enough in terms of enhancing what ECOWAS is doing in the effort of building trust, building structures to embrace the tenets of democracy? Because Gambia, for a long time, was under so-called a dictatorship. You won an election. This is you defeated former President Yahya Jammeh. You came back. You won re-election. So talk to me about the role the Gambia is playing.
Well, Gambia represents a beacon of hope in the region. We managed to have a very peaceful election without one single incident of violence during the whole process. And I hope we will not change our electoral system, because it's unique in the world.
Some people say it's too fake, or it's too old, archaic.
Well, you know, people, when they don't understand things, they tend to make judgments. But I think people should come and see for themselves. And I will refer you to an article by the BBC, The Sounds of Democracy. And, you know, sometimes Africa, we tend to just follow trends without being prepared enough to deal with them. Because whenever you want to do something, there are some prerequisites that have to be in place. But today, I think our system is suitable because of the size of the population. It's very transparent. You know, you have representative of all the political parties. The everything is counted in front of them. So there is no way to cheat, you know. The challenge is to convince people to go and vote. In the presidential election, we are like almost 95%. That is unheard of in Africa. And then everything went peacefully very well. And now that we've done that, our challenge is to sustain peace.
That was Foreign Minister Mamadou Tangara speaking with VOA's Peter Kiloti on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York. Several human rights organizations and Sudanese citizens held a rally in front of the White House, urging the Biden administration to address the conflict in their country, protect civilians, and increase humanitarian aid. The fighting between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitaries of the Rapid Support Forces is in its sixth month with no end in sight. Nabil Biagio attended the rally and filed this report.
5 million displaced. Dozens of Sudanese living in the United States braved heavy rain to gather in front of the White House, urging support for millions of people affected by the conflict back home. Fatima Ramram, a Sudanese-American at Saturday's rally, said her family had been displaced from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Some relocated to the northern part of the country, while others became refugees in Egypt.
I'm here just to need attention from President Biden. We need help for Sudan people. They like suffering. They need shelter. They need food. They need safety. They need to be like, you know, in a safe place for children too. Myself, I guess, a witness for people in Egypt. I saw people, a woman with 5 kids, she has nothing. She's like, they like sleeping in the floor without no food, and they get, you know, one of the child, he gets raped, you know, 8 years old, and then she has nothing. She has nothing to eat or a safety or a shelter. So for those people, we need their attention. For those people, we need, need help, urgent help.
Demonstrator Isra An-Nur urged U.S. President Joe Biden to push for a peaceful settlement of the conflict.
It's a huge humanitarian situation right now. People are dying. There isn't enough medical infrastructure, humanitarian aid pathways. Millions and millions have evacuated, more than they have from Afghanistan, more than they have from Iraq, from Syria, from Yemen. It's an absolutely horrendous situation in Sudan, and I'm here to bring awareness to that and advocate for the voices of the Sudanese who are unable to be here. And hopefully, we really hope to see a political solution in this war. And we hope that all warring parties return to the negotiating table.
Nur acknowledged efforts by the Biden administration through the Jeddah platform to broker ceasefires in Sudan. She also pointed out sanctions the State Department imposed on two leaders of the paramilitary group, the RSF, including the brother of its leader, Abdurrahim Hamdan Dagalo. She thinks Biden should do more.
I think this administration has done a lot to bring awareness and to try to cease the hostilities and bring a long-term ceasefire, but there can always be more done. I think just sanctioning Abdurrahim Dagalo is not going to do enough. I don't think that these sanctions right now are going to really move the needle for them. So we need to see some pretty bold movement from this administration, from Congress.
Khidr Dallouk is a board member of the Sudanese American Physicians Association, one of the groups that organized the rally and has been active in the humanitarian response in Sudan. He highlighted the dire conditions in hospitals and shortages of medical supplies.
80% of hospitals, you know, are shut down. The situation in Darfur is even worse. There are almost 14 million children who need urgent humanitarian crisis, including vaccines. Kids are dying from malnutrition. About 3 or 5 of them are dying every day in what Madani Hospital. And the health care system is just crumbling. And if we don't act now, we are not going to be able to save the people.
Saturday's rally was organized by international non-governmental organizations such as Amnesty International USA, Human Rights Watch, Refugees International, Refugee Congress, as well as Sudanese groups such as Sudan Unlimited, Act for Sudan, and Grifna. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
A new report by weather experts say the warming planet made floods like the recent one in Libya 50 times more likely. Thousands died in the flood and thousands more are missing. Kathleen Grady is a George Washington University Assistant Professor of Engineering Management and Systems Engineer. She tells VOA's Carol Van Dam much of the adaptation that's already occurred in Africa and Asia is happening on an individual level.
So it's one individual, like a farmer, deciding to adapt to something happening in his or her own community, what patterns they see in the weather, indicating what they're going to do on their land, whether or not they're going to build their own, you know, mini dam to try and hold back water or manage floods on their own accord. And that's a lot of the adaptation that's occurring, particularly in Africa. Now we see larger scale adaptations occurring worldwide still through policy-driven interventions, a lot of work happening through initiatives spearheaded by treaty and conventions under the UNFCCC and funding coming out of these global funds like the Global Environmental Facility, the GEF, that are supporting adaptation to climate change.
You say most of these activities are happening on an individual level, but I would imagine that what we really need is things to happen on a much bigger scale, like even global. And as you know, UNGA, the UN General Assembly, is happening this week. And one of the major topics is climate change and how do we address it globally? So you're the researcher, you're the professor on this kind of thing. If you had their ears, their eyes and ears, what would you tell world leaders?
Oh, that's a good question. I would try to encourage world leaders to create sustaining commitments. So we've seen a lot of great progress, especially in the last few years, of commitments to fund adaptation, commitments of governments to give money to adaptation. But they're not always sustaining commitments. What I mean by that, they might be a one-time promise of funding, and they're not a 10, 20, 30, 40, 50-year commitment to have this work ongoing. And we need that. So ongoing commitments, sustaining commitments to fund and support adaptation is one. Another thing I would encourage the global community broadly to think about is the ways in which we can streamline bureaucracy. This is true both in the United States and in the UN, that there's a lot of challenges, time that needs to be factored in to processes because of bureaucracy. So are there ways that we can streamline adaptation behaviors where, you know, a farmer or a community or a city that needs to plan for dams like in Libya can have a faster response time to accessing technical assistance or funding or whatever it is that they need?
What are some of these ideas that you're talking about that countries can do that would help? You know, in a place like Libya, obviously those two dams broke. It could have been less devastating.
Yeah. Well, in Libya, I think part of the catastrophe was not just that we had this extreme rainfall event, but also that we had years of neglect, years of not maintaining the two dams. And in fact, my understanding is there were supposed to be 3 dams in this same area to account for the water, and the 3rd dam was never built. So in that regard, what regions can do, what cities can do, what countries can do, is they can plan for a longer process of maintenance and longer process of implementation. And there are some cities that are doing climate adaptation planning.
That's Kathleen Grady, a George Washington University Assistant Professor of Engineering and Systems Management. She spoke to VOA's Carol Van Dam in Washington. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.